Thank you for joining us today for a message from the Word of God. What follows is a recording from one of our live services at Gooch Lane Church of Christ in Huntsville, Alabama. If you're ever in the area, we'd love to have you join us in person. And if you like what you hear today, you can visit us online at teachingtruth.org, where we have videos, weekly articles on biblical topics, information about our services, and more.
He was a chief tax collector and was rich, and he was seeking to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was small in stature. So he ran on ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was about to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried and came down and received him joyfully. And when they saw it, they all grumbled, "He has gone in to be the guest of a man who is a sinner." And Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold." And Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, since he also is a son of Abraham, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost." Jesus has a tendency, if you study his life, to be like a faith magnet. What I mean by that is that Jesus always seems to find faith, just like a magnet finds metal. That Jesus sometimes seems to create faith so that people who encounter him, while they begin maybe not believing or only having a little faith, they leave having a much greater faith. And he seems to draw out faith. And he does all of that in unexpected places. That is, he finds faith, he creates faith, he draws out faith from places that we would not expect. And so I want to think with you about the fact that if we were going to start a movement in Jesus' day, we would probably not at all do it the way he did it. If I was going to start a movement and I was Jesus, I would probably go first to, when we out? It's not even on, okay. Now, I told him when I came that I'm an Aggie. And I don't know if you guys in Alabama know this, but in Texas there are all kinds of jokes about Aggies. And if you're going to hand us a mic, you want it to be something we don't have to do any buttons on or anything. It's a little complicated. No, I appreciate that. Thanks for the heads up there. All right, so what were we talking about? If we were going to start a movement, if I were to start a movement, I would start with the famous, well-trained rabbis. That's where I would go first. These are the people who would be on my wavelength first, and so I would start with them, and maybe then I would get some of the scribes and the lawyers and some scholars, and I'd get those people together. You know, Jesus doesn't do anything like that, does he? Jesus instead finds all kinds of different kinds of people, unexpected people. Everything he does and everything he deals with is unexpected. And so I want us to think about that, how Jesus seems to find and draw out faith in unexpected places. And the two reasons I want to talk about this tonight are because we need to understand that sometimes he will draw faith out of us and create faith in us in unexpected ways. And secondly, I want us to see that we need to be prepared for the fact that faith doesn't come the way we always think it would come. Sometimes it will shock us to see the kinds of people who come to Jesus, just like if we had been there in the first century, it would have shocked us to see who the people were who ended up coming to Jesus. So let's talk about, I want to cover four stories tonight. The first is this man, the corrupt public official, the man called Zacchaeus. Now it says in Luke 19 and verse 2 that he was a chief tax collector and was rich. A chief tax collector. One scholar says this means he was head of the Jericho tax cartel. That gives you a good feel for it. Taxes were notoriously corrupt under the Roman system, and Jews who collected taxes were known to be corrupt because not only are they in collusion with Rome, but also the Roman government would give a certain amount they expected in taxes, and then they just sort of let the tax collectors collect whatever they wanted. So if there was a discrepancy, if you collected too much and Rome only wanted so much, guess what you got? You got the rest. And of course, everyone knows that about tax collectors. That's one of the reasons their names are a byword in the New Testament, is because everyone knows those are people who are cheaters. Tax collectors were not only cheaters, they were universally hated. So again, if you were going to start a movement, how many tax collectors do you think you'd start with? Doesn't seem like a very promising area. Now, Zacchaeus is, in verse 2, a chief tax collector, which means he is up in the organization. He has moved up. He has been promoted. And it also says that he was rich. And so if a chief tax collector is rich, there is one way he can be rich. It is because he is using his position in that way I just described. So when Jesus goes to this man's house, remember we know this little cute story about he climbs up in the sycamore tree. It's not quite so cute when you think about what kind of man this probably was. He wanted to see Jesus, and yet he is a corrupt public official. So in verse 7, it says, when they saw that Jesus was going to Zacchaeus' house, they all grumbled, he has gone in to be the guest of a man who is a sinner. These people know Zacchaeus. In fact, I would say they know him a lot better than you and I do. So, you know, we might, and I've heard people have some differences of opinion about this characterization of Zacchaeus, but I've got to say the people there knew what he was about. They knew where he got his money. They knew how he built his fancy house. They knew him. And they say, of all the people in this town, why would you go to his house? He is a sinner. But Jesus says an interesting thing. He looks up in the sycamore tree and sees Zacchaeus. And it says in verse 5 that Jesus says, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. That must is just a fascinating word. If you ever study single words in the New Testament, study that word must, or it is a word that means it is necessary. It is something that's essential for me to do. It's a word Jesus uses all the time as a mission word. I must go through Samaria. I must. This is what must happen. I have no choice about it. This is my mission. I must come to your house today. Something is going to happen there that it is essential for me to be present for. Verse 8, and Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold. And Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, since he also is a son of Abraham, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. So the way I read this text, and again, you may read it differently, but the way I read it, Zacchaeus in this moment makes a change. And he decides, he stands up in the presence of Jesus and says, you know what, Lord, I'm ready to change. I don't want to be the person I have been. I don't want everybody to whisper about me as a sinner. I don't want to use my position for evil. I'm going to do good. And he makes some commitments in verse 8. The half of my goods I give to the poor. If I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold. Now, if that was Zacchaeus' prior life, people are probably not going to be grumbling about him as a sinner, right? If he's given half his goods all the time, and any time he does a wrong thing on the books, he restores it fourfold. They would say, no, Zacchaeus is a good man. And yet, here he is, committing to something. And Jesus says in verse 9, today, salvation has come to this house, because he also is a son of Abraham. The Son of Man has come to seek and to save the lost. Men like Zacchaeus, who are corrupt, who are sinners, who everyone knows what they're doing and how they got to be who they are. Jesus said, I came for people like that, lost people. Do you see how Jesus is a faith magnet? Walking through Jericho, he looks up in a tree and says, that's the guy. That's the one. Something's going to change in his life today. Today, salvation will come to his house. I especially want, as you think about this story, I want to draw your attention to the difference in how people view Zacchaeus and how Jesus views Zacchaeus. They look differently at him. The people feel that he is unworthy of attention. They grumble about it. He's not worthy of praise. He's not worthy of visiting. He's not even worthy of notice. Why would you want to be his guest? But Jesus looks at Zacchaeus, and he sees reason for hope. He sees potential for change. He sees a man who's excited about something, even if it's just climbing up in a tree to see him. Something good is happening, and Jesus says, that's the man I need to go see and work with. He sees faith in an unexpected place, and he draws that faith out to the point that he says, Zacchaeus, today salvation has come to your house. You also are a son of Abraham. Let's look at a second story. Let's go back to Luke chapter 7. Let's talk about a foreign soldier. Luke 7 and verse 1. Luke 7, 1, after he had finished all his sayings and the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. Luke 7, 2, now a centurion had a servant who was sick and at the point of death, who was highly valued by him. When the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent to him the elders of the Jews, asking him to come and to heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they pleaded with him earnestly, saying, he's worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he is the one who built us our synagogue. And Jesus went with them. When he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you, but say the word, and let my servant be healed. For I too am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him, and turning to the crowd that followed him, said, I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the servant well. Now, centurion, as you likely know, is a Roman soldier who was over 100 men in the Roman army, and he is part of the occupying force in Galilee. Just think about the tension that's involved in an occupying force. You are there, the people don't like you, and you don't like the people. Not to mention, there are some significant religious differences, some cultural differences, some language differences between these two groups, the Roman army and the Jewish people. What we wouldn't expect in a situation like this, looking at a man in the Roman army, what we would not expect is a thoughtful, respectful, caring, believing, humble man. We would not expect that. And yet, Jesus seems to find people like that everywhere he goes. Have you noticed? Just seems to draw them out. They come out to him. He is like a magnet for their faith. So in verse 2, it says, a centurion who had a servant who was sick and at the point of death, who was highly valued by him. So that detail, by the way, humanizes the centurion. He's not just a soldier. He cares a lot about his servant. He loves this servant. And so when the servant is sick and at the point of death, he acts to intervene. And in fact, he sends some of the elders of the Jews who have great things to say about him. Isn't it interesting that there is a soldier who the Jews themselves say, this guy, he's one of the good ones. Yeah, I know he's a Roman, I know he's a soldier, but he is worthy to have you do this for him. He built us a synagogue. He is a good man. Verse 6, when he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you, but say the word and let my servant be healed. Now think about that. You know, Jews felt that they did not want to be in the same room with a Gentile because they would be defiled by them. But here is a centurion who says, I am not worthy to come under your roof. You are too great for me. So I'm not even going to presume to come to you. And then he says something that is truly amazing. He says in verse 7, you just say the word and let my servant be healed. Then he explains his reasoning, which, by the way, is equally fascinating. Verse 8, for I too am a man set under authority with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. See, the reason he thinks saying the word will work for Jesus is because he says, I'm in the army. You know how the army works? You give an order, and it's executed. You say it, and when you say the word, it's as good as done. He says, I'm a man who's under authority, because there are generals above me, but I'm also over some, because I'm over 100 men as a centurion, and I know what this is like. Sometimes people above me say the word, and I have to go do it, but sometimes I say the word, and they have to go do it, but Jesus, I know you're like me. You're under authority, the Father, and you're also over authority. You have others under you. You say the word, and however that works, somehow the world will change in response to your word. Now, that is some awesome faith. In fact, Jesus marvels in verse 9. He says, I've not found faith like this, even in Israel, even among the people of God. They don't know what this stranger, this foreign soldier, understands. There is a small handful of times in the Old Testament where you have foreigners who are talked about in a positive way. Just a few of them. Men like Naaman, who after some reluctance becomes a believer in Yahweh God. But most of the time in the Old Testament, foreigners are enemies. They're not to be trusted. They're not to be associated with. You don't marry them. You don't hang out with them. They are not a source of faith. But this man was different. He had unexpected faith. I wonder so many things about this man. I wonder what he knew. I wonder what his past was like. I wonder what interactions he had had with Jesus prior to this. I wonder what brought him to a point where he would make a request like this in this way. But here is what I know. Jesus knows about his nationality, and he honors his faith all the more because it's unexpected. Not even in Israel have I found faith like this. It's amazing to see this from someone like this. So again, you see Jesus drawing out faith from unexpected places. Let's look at a third story in Luke chapter 7. Luke 7, back a couple of pages. Well, actually up one page in Luke 7. And this is the story of a notorious woman. Luke 7 and verse 36. We read a little of this in this morning's lesson as we talked about grace. Luke 7 and verse 36, it says, "One of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him. And he went into the Pharisee's house and reclined at table. And behold, a woman of the city who was a sinner, when she learned that he was reclining at table at the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment, and standing behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears, and wiped them with the hair of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, 'If this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner.'" Now this woman is an uninvited guest to the supper. Nobody asked her to be here. She just sort of wanders in. And we know a couple of things about her. In verse 37, it says, "This is a woman of the city who was a sinner." And then verse 39, the Pharisee thinks she is a sinner. Most scholars believe that this is a reference to prostitution, that she was a sinner who was known in the city because of the style of her sin, the type of sin she was involved with. Luke identifies her as a sinner. Simon identifies her as a sinner. She was notorious. But notice what she is doing and what is happening. She is weeping. She is anointing Jesus' feet with ointment. This is a hard scene for me to picture because I always struggle with picturing how these ancient Jews ate. If you've ever studied this, you know that they reclined at table, which, I don't know, I guess I'm too busy getting busy eating to be leaning back. But Jesus has his feet behind him. She is over his feet, and she is weeping uncontrollably to the point that her tears are drenching his feet. And then she takes her hair and wipes his feet. And then she takes ointment and anoints them and kisses his feet. Just imagine. Just imagine you're at this dinner with all these Pharisees and religious leaders, and here is this woman who is notorious, and she begins to make a scene. And the room begins to fill with the smell of this ointment. And I just picture, you know, that the conversation sort of stops as everybody kind of looks at the woman and then looks at Jesus. Is he going to say anything? What's going on here? One of the most interesting parts of this story is when Jesus asks in verse 44, "Do you see this woman?" Which I think is hilarious. Everybody saw this woman. Everybody knows what's going on. She's making a scene. So I want you to think about what is propelling her to come in where Jesus is and to weep over him. Jesus responds to this by telling a story. In verse 41, he says, "A certain moneylender had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. When they could not pay, he canceled the debt of both. Now, which of them will love him more?" Simon answered, "The one, I suppose, for whom he canceled the larger debt." And he said to him, "You have judged rightly." So I hope you get that story. He says, basically, the person who's forgiven a bigger debt is going to love the person who forgave them more than the person forgiven a smaller debt. Verse 44, "Then turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, 'Do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But he who is forgiven little, loves little. And he said to her, "Your sins are forgiven." Then those who were at table with him began to say among themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" And he said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." So Jesus says, you know, this woman has done far more for me than you did when you invited me over to your house. You didn't even give me the typical greeting. You didn't give me water to wash my feet. And here she is. She's kissing me. She's weeping over me. She is doing far more because she loves more. But why does she love more? Because when you've been forgiven a lot, you love a lot. When you feel that what you've done is so bad that there's no way out, and yet God says, "No, I forgive even you," it motivates you in a deeper way than someone who feels like their sins are just not that big a deal. That's the difference between Simon and the woman. Now again, I wish we had more background here. I wish we knew more about this woman's story and how she knew Jesus. It seems clear to me that this is not the first time they've met, because otherwise it would just be her meeting someone, not speaking, and then crying over his feet. He also talks to her about how she has been forgiven. But the main draw here seems to me to be that Jesus treats her as if she is still lovable, even though she has sinned greatly. I want you to hear that. She's still worthy of love. She's still worthy of attention. He still accepts her faith, even though she has sinned greatly. And when we love people that way and treat them that way, faith can blossom. If you can look past just the facts of what someone has done to the heart behind the person, faith can grow. Simon, the Pharisee, meanwhile, has no love for Jesus, no concern for him at all, and the reason is he doesn't feel like he needs forgiveness. And it's very hard for faith to grow when we don't feel much need for God and what he offers us. And so you end up with the exact opposite of what you would expect, right? You would expect between a Pharisee and a woman who's a prostitute that one of them's going to have faith and the other won't, but you would get it exactly wrong. Instead, it is the Pharisee who has not enough faith and this notorious woman who pleases Jesus. Let's look in Luke chapter 9 and see this fourth story. Luke 9. I want to talk about the renegade exorcist. Luke chapter 9. I want to read beginning in verse 46. Luke 9 and verse 46. It says, "An argument arose among them as to which of them was the greatest. But Jesus, knowing the reasoning of their hearts, took a child and put him by his side and said to them, 'Whoever receives this child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For he who is least among you all is the one who is great.' John answered, 'Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him, because he does not follow with us.' But Jesus said to him, 'Do not stop him, for the one who is not against you is for you.'" Now, we could talk about children here because he highlights them. And by the way, that is another unexpected place where Jesus draws our attention. Instead of focusing on the adults, he says, "Look at the children. There is a blessing there." But the reason I believe that this text is connected is that he seems to talk about receiving children. And John, in verse 49, thinks about someone they didn't receive. And so he asked Jesus a question. "Master," verse 49, "we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him. We didn't receive him because he does not follow with us." There were people going around with Jesus and his entourage. People like John, people like the other disciples, a group of them. And he says, "But we came across someone who was not with us, who was still casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him." Is John worried that the man's going to teach something wrong? That's possible. That in some way he's going to damage Jesus' name or Jesus' cause because he's doing his own thing? That's possible. Did he encourage him to follow with them, but the man refused and said, "No, I'm going to do my own thing"? We don't know the story, but what we know is something's going on with this man, and John is presenting this as a confusing situation to Jesus. What should we do here? Verse 50. "But Jesus said to him, 'Do not stop him, for the one who is not against you is for you.'" Jesus seems to be aware of the situation. By the way, Jesus probably knows who the guy is and what his story is in ways that John does not. But he simply says, "John, your assumption is wrong. your assumption that this guy is not doing the right thing, to assume that someone who doesn't follow with us is not following Jesus, is incorrect. Because Jesus can raise up disciples from unexpected places and in unexpected ways. This is, again, not what we would expect. It's not what the disciples expected. You can see their confusion. How could this be? We would expect everybody will need to be taught by Jesus, that they would all need Jesus' stamp of approval, especially before they're going to cast out demons. I mean, how do they even do that? We don't know. We would expect that they would need to walk with the disciples and learn directly from Jesus, that they would need to work together. But that's not what Jesus says. He does not say, yeah, get them into the group. They need to walk with us. Instead, he says, no, do not stop him. You know, sometimes Jesus does this. Sometimes he adopts people into his entourage, and sometimes he says, you stay where you are and do my work. Like to the Gadarene demoniac, who after his many demons are cast out, he wants to follow with Jesus, and Jesus says, no, you go home, and you tell them what happened to you, what the Lord has done for you. Or the woman at the well that we talked about this morning. She goes to her city and tells the people of Sychar about this man who told me all that I ever did, and many come to faith through her. Sometimes he leaves people like this guy, whoever he is, to go do that work in the way that just he and that guy seem to know about. Somehow he's doing the work of Jesus. He's not against him, but for him. I've got to tell you, that's unexpected. I did not expect that Jesus would work that way, and yet here he does. So what do we make of all of this? I've given you four stories. I hope you see the thread that very often Jesus seems to draw out and raise faith in people in unexpected places and unexpected ways. I want to leave you with just a few thoughts and we'll be done. The first thing I want you to see is that these stories help us broaden our vision of God's work. When we talk about expectations, which is our theme tonight, faith in unexpected places, what we're really talking about is how we think about God, what we expect God to do, what we expect God to be like, how we expect God to come across to us. And we just have to remember that our expectations of God can be wrong, and that very often they're far too small. That God is bigger than what we think of him. And we need to broaden that sense of who God is and what he can do. We just don't expect God to work in people who are corrupt and sinful, who are notorious, who are foreign, who are different, who are outside of our group. And Jesus says, broaden your perspective. Broaden your vision. We need to remember that God's work is not dependent on us. That God will get his work done whether we do it or not. Now, that doesn't mean that there will be no consequences for us if we refuse to do God's work. What it means is God's not going to be limited by my disobedience or my inaction. He's bigger than that. That would mean that I am limiting God. Our vision has to be bigger than that. We need to remember that God can reach unexpected people, people that you and I would not expect to respond. He does it all the time. Jesus does it all the time. And if you were to ask, if you polled the disciples, what do you think of Zacchaeus? What do you think they would say? Why are we going to his house? If you polled the disciples and say, hey, what do you think about that centurion? Do we really have to talk to him? If you were to poll the disciples, every one of them would say, I'm not so sure about this Jesus. And yet here is Jesus saying, you need to listen to me instead of telling me what you are expecting. We need to remember that God's work is not limited to us. This is Jesus' statement in John 10 and verse 16. He says, I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock, one shepherd. I believe here he's talking about Gentiles. But what a fascinating idea that is. He says, I've got some sheep. They're not Jewish sheep. They're a little bit scattered. And I've got to go find them and bring them so that there will be one flock and one shepherd, which is the fulfillment of a number of Old Testament prophecies. Isn't that interesting? God's been at work even among the Gentiles. That's the idea. He is not limited to us. So what I am encouraging in us is that we broaden our sense that God is who he is. Can I say a little bit about how that plays out, at least in my experience in our time? Very often I hear Christians talk about how dismal the outlook is for churches in our day. Sometimes that'll be a statistical thing. Our young people, we talked yesterday about the facts about what happens as young people transition into adulthood and that many of them lose their faith. And there are some sobering statistics about that. And sometimes people will talk about that and they'll say things like, you know, nobody's interested in the gospel anymore. Sometimes they'll talk about, you know, back in the day, we would have, you know, month-long meetings and people would come every night. Now you can't get people to come to a meeting for this or that. Do we not remember who we're dealing with? This is God. Is his word somehow going to not work in 2024? Now, suddenly people have gotten to a point where God can't save people anymore. Can't reach them. Do we really think that when Jesus says, you're Peter and on this rock I'll build my church and the gates of death will not prevail against it, that somehow now the gates of hell, the gates of death are going to prevail? Sorry, we just live in a bad time. It seems to me that we need that sense of confidence Jesus had, that it is God we are working with, and God is going to reach people, and his gospel is going to reach people. And our job is not to question that or doubt that or even be discouraged by that. Our job is to go sow the seed and get ready, because God's going to do his work to broaden our vision of who God is and what he's doing, and that perhaps that might look different than what we would expect. These stories help us to look for the good in others. I just love this about Jesus. I just love this about Jesus. He sees progress. He sees good. He sees potential. He sees movement toward God. He sees love in these people. He sees things that nobody else around them seems to see. He looks differently. And other people consistently seem to see the bad. They see Zacchaeus and what they see. Nobody should go to his house. He is a sinner. They see this woman and they say, don't let her touch him. She's a sinner. Don't go to his house. Don't use Jesus' name if you're not with us. They say, no, there's nothing good going on here. There's only problems. So my question is, if Jesus sees the good and the rest of the people in these stories see the bad, which one of those are we going to choose? Are we going to look at the people around us and see good or see bad? Would we be able to see that the centurion was moving toward God? Or would we get stuck on the fact that he was a Roman? Didn't even worship the right God. Would we be able to see Zacchaeus' repentant heart? Or would we focus on the misdeeds he had already done? I want to tell you, everybody in the world, including you and me, everybody in the world is a figure like these figures in these stories. There's some good and some bad. So which one of those are we going to focus on? What are we going to see? And if we're not able to see the good, then maybe we won't be able to help them toward faith the way Jesus does. So is your default mode to find fault and to criticize and to doubt and to worry and to exclude? Or is your default mode to accept and to look for the best and to encourage? Which one of those is more like Jesus? These stories help us look for good in others. And finally, these stories help us engage rather than shun people. I want you to notice that in all these stories, there's some distance between Jesus and the people. Don't go to Zacchaeus' house. Keep your distance. The centurion feels unworthy to even come to Jesus' roof. There's a distance between them. The woman shouldn't be touching Jesus. There's a distance that should be there. The exorcist is not allowed to keep exorcising demons. There should be a distance between Jesus' people and him. And yet, in each case, Jesus takes a step toward the person rather than away. Every time, he engages them rather than shunning them. This is Jesus' default. Jesus goes into Zacchaeus' house. Jesus approaches and praises the centurion. Jesus engages the woman. Jesus vindicates the exorcist. He engages rather than shunning. Do you see that in Jesus? if our only settings are I'm in complete agreement with this person, or else I'm going to shun them, if those are our only two settings, then we're going to miss people like these who are coming to faith, but maybe they're not quite there yet. They're coming to faith, but maybe they're not quite on our wavelength about their culture. They're coming to faith, but maybe they're not quite there yet, and so they're still living some things that they shouldn't. They're coming to faith, but they still have questions and doubts and worries. They're coming to faith, but they still have some baggage. They're coming to faith, but they're not doing it exactly the right way. And if our only settings are, I can either be in complete agreement with you, or you have nothing to do with me, then we're going to miss those people. But Jesus does not. He engages them rather than shunning them. I just wonder how many people are trying to come to faith in Jesus, but they have same-sex attraction. They're trying to come to Jesus, but they have tattoos and a drinking problem. They're trying to come to Jesus, but they're divorced and lonely. And they're trying to come to Jesus, but they're mistrustful of other people because they have a deep set of scars, some physical and some emotional. They're trying. The question is, what response will they get from us? Will we engage them, or will we shun them because in some way that doesn't fit what we would expect? It is easy for us to shun. In fact, it might even be more comfortable for us to shun, but it's more Jesus-like to engage. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm certainly not saying that we just wink at sin and say sin is not a big deal. What I am saying is, if we're going to deal with sinners, we already know they're going to be living a life of sin. But how can we call them out of it? How can we encourage them and become close to them so that we can share the gospel with them if all we do is stay away? Jesus engages rather than shunning people, and so he draws out faith from unexpected places. So our job is to be like Jesus, to have that broader vision, to look for the good, and to engage rather than shunning people. Jesus draws out faith. I want you to think about that picture, Jesus as a faith magnet. And then I want to ask you, how do you measure up to that? Do you feel the same way about yourself? That when people are around you, they're drawn closer to God? That you bring out the best in people, that you see the best in people, that you step toward them rather than away from them? How much are you following in those footsteps of Jesus? Something to think about. And if there is a change that you need to make, I encourage you to let this week be a time where you ask yourself those hard questions and make those hard changes. So our job is to watch for Jesus and to celebrate and to encourage the faith he produces in unexpected places. Thank you so much for your attention tonight. This is the time of our service where we want to offer an invitation. Right? We're doing an invitation tonight. I want you to know there's a reason we do this. It's because as we sit and listen to God's word, sometimes these words sting us. And we hear, I need to make a change. I'm not what I should be right now. And so this is a time where, as a group, we let it be known that, yes, we understand. We are also convicted by the word. And we want you to know, we want to help anyone here who is ready to take a step toward the Lord, who is ready to give their life over to Jesus, to be baptized into Christ, have their sins washed away, who is ready to confess some problem in their life and have us pray with you and help you with that. We want this to be a time where you draw closer to the Lord. So if we can help you, we invite you to come to the front as we stand and sing to encourage you.
Thanks again for joining us today. If you have questions about anything you heard today or anything Bible related, you can use the contact form on our website at teachingtruth.org to submit a question and someone will be in touch. There's also lots of other great Bible content on our site as well. The web address again is teachingtruth.org. Once again, thanks for listening, and we hope to see you in person soon.